few years ago, in a peak of folly, I published an article entitled Peter, Paul, and Fred. Today, I'd like to talk to you about Peter, Paul, and Jesus. You can ask me later who Fred was, but we can deal with that another time. Our symposium, as I understand it, has been charged to examine the extent to which recent scholarship on Jesus and on Paul has advanced our understanding of the classic problem of the relationship between them. Have we learned anything new? Are today's answers any advance on those offered in the classic treatments of the past century? My approach to this question will be somewhat oblique, musing aloud, you might say, about a question that arises for me out of a longer-term interest in the Apostle Peter. I wish to ask what role Simon Peter might play as a kind of index or perhaps a litmus test for the way new perspective Pauline scholarship has related to the Jesus of the so-called third quest for the historical Jesus. In order to focus this inquiry, I'd like to treat Peter's profile in the work of scholars who've been active in both endeavors, i.e. who have written monographs on both sides of that inquiry. My conclusion will then offer one or two modest ways forward. Simon Peter is arguably the only major player in the ministries of both Jesus and Paul, and on any reckoning, he provides a vital personal continuity between them both. What writers of books on both Paul and on Jesus may say about this man should, in theory, have some bearing on how their work in these two areas coheres, or perhaps doesn't, as the case may be. The image of Peter lends itself to being examined without obvious prejudice to some of the key questions that drive the traditional Jesus-Paul debate. He is important to both Paul and to the Jesus tradition, and yet also comes in for very significant criticism in both Paul and the Jesus tradition. Conversely, the contrast between the Jesus tradition's virtually exclusive mission to Israel and the Pauline mission to Gentiles suggests that there could be some analytical benefit in reflecting on Simon Peter's connection with both of those endeavors. Now, classically, and we must be aware of this, 19th and 20th century critical scholarship tended to see Peter as a kind of vacillating but ultimately reactionary figure who failed to understand either Jesus or Paul. And here my aim is not really to propose a reassessment of that picture, although a byproduct of my conclusion may be to suggest ways forward. My main aim really for this paper is a kind of Petrine cross-section through some of the best of the newer scholarship in order to discover how it conceives of the vexed old problem that is the interface between Jesus and Paul. I'd like to say just a few words about both the third quest and the new perspective before then looking at some of the major players. Turning first to recent Jesus research, we find ourselves immediately confronted with the reality of 20 years of trench warfare between two irreconcilable schools of thought. On the one hand, are those whose historical reconstruction departs from what you might say is a minimal stock of sayings, largely culled from an early version of the hypothetical saying source Q and the apocryphal Gospel of Thomas. Opposed to them are scholars who, while differing widely on questions of historicity, take a more sanguine estimation of the value of certain narrative features of the tradition, alongside sayings, and sometimes even prioritizing certain acts of Jesus over his words, as, for example, E.P. Sanders famously did. And they would also place particular emphasis on the Jewish context of Jesus' ministry and the reasons for his death. Now, chronicles and analyses and typologies of the lively debate between these two schools of thought are widely available, covering the last quarter century or so, and I don't wish to be detained by that here. Perhaps suffice it to say that a number of observers and even participants in the debate have become somewhat doubtful that N.T. Wright's astonishingly influential declaration of an identifiable third quest 2 decades ago, that this identification actually captures the reality on the ground, either at that time or indeed since then. The reality seems to some observers rather more bifurcated, rather more polymorphous than what Tom Wright appears to have identified. Even the third quest nomenclature's implicit characterization of the preceding research has been questioned because it seems to distort and to sideline much of what in fact transpired, for example, between 1920 and 1950, or for that matter, in subsequent work like that of Jeremias Gerhardsen and the Scandinavian School. Also, some critics have said that they find themselves unable to recognize three distinct phases of Jesus' research in any case, while others, in fact, have said that you can identify as many as nine. So in seeking to engage with Jesus, let alone the Peter of the so-called third quest, we're dealing with a moving target. We're dealing with perhaps even a phantom, which may be quite difficult to identify. A further problem is that so much of the debate seems to have been an Anglo-American, or indeed, dare I say it, an internal American pastime. The Jesus Seminar's star, which is perhaps now waning, never in fact rose in the scholarly firmament of continental Europe, and similar observations might be made about other high-profile positions within the so-called third quest for the historical Jesus. Indeed, with the exception of Gerd Tyson and perhaps Gerd Ludemann, German scholarship, for example, has been virtually absent from this enterprise. Even to many sympathetic observers, and I would count myself as one of them, it seems unclear what, if anything, is the bottom line gain of these two extraordinarily prolific decades of Jesus research. We continue to be deeply divided about such issues as the balance of sapiential and apocalyptic elements in the earliest Jesus tradition, about its concern for a deliberate abrogation or supersession of a common temple and Torah-centered Judaism. Perhaps at the end of the day, the one main upshot of the third quest is, as John Meyer has suggested, its, quote, ringing affirmation of the Jewishness of the flesh the Word assumed. Even in his original identification of a third quest, N.T. Wright already regarded this as the central agreement uniting its diverse practitioners, that is to say, the determination to set Jesus in the context of Judaism on the one hand and of the early church on the other. If true, that, of course, would be a gain well worth celebrating. The only problem, of course, is that this conclusion is far from unanimously held among recent makers of books on Jesus. And even where it is held, the Jewishness of Jesus is so disparately rendered that one may still be permitted to wonder what is really meant by it. The degree of dissonance on this question was recently brought home to me by a review in a recent issue of the Catholic Biblical Quarterly, which slated a Scandinavian dissertation on prayer in the Jesus tradition for failing to do justice to what the reviewer thought were several important third quest elements. Now, the work under review hadn't really attempted to position itself in these terms, but nevertheless, it was telling to note the supposed lacunae for which this work was criticized. They included an emphasis on extra-canonical traditions, especially the Gospel of Thomas, comparative social science perspectives, including the so-called horizon of Mediterranean patronage, as delineated by Bruce Molina, the recognition that mainstream Jewish prayer texts, in fact, merely represent the views of powerful elites, which Jesus, as a Galilean peasant, did not follow, but rather sought to subvert, and an acceptance that the synoptic scribes suppressed the political dimensions of the original Jesus movement, quote, for obvious ideological reasons, as has been demonstrated, said the reviewer, by Third Quest work in the United States. My point here is not to deny that some, or perhaps even all, of these ideas have been prominently asserted in recent work on Jesus, but merely to point out that several of these are at best peripheral to the work of many other leading authors associated with the so-called Third Quest, including every one of those scholars identified in that original discussion by N.T. Wright. It's at this point that one begins to wonder if there is a meaningful designation here at all. Perhaps one simply pays one's SBL dues and takes one's choice from its cafeteria of quests. Or one could, with James Dunn most recently, simply trump the whole lot of them and declare one's own work, claiming the high ground, to be the new perspective on Jesus. What about on the Pauline side? What's new about the new perspective? Things appear initially somewhat simpler and clearer. One could justly question whether what writers like Sanders and Dunn offer is a new perspective on Paul or perhaps rather a new perspective on Paul's Judaism. And it is debatable if Sanders invented or merely popularized a less Protestant reading of Judaism. Certainly, a number of Sanders's most influential insights in this department were previously advanced by writers like C.G. Montefiore, George Foote Moore, Christopher Stendahl, and others. Nevertheless, it remains the case that there is recognizable overlap between Sanders and those like James Dunn, N.T. Wright, and others who have been linked with what has come to be known as the New Perspective on Paul. One shared feature of this approach includes the recognition that Judaism, too, it was overwhelmingly affirmed salvation in the first instance by covenantal gift rather than by human merit, so that Paul's reaction against an emphasis on works of the law tends to be seen in this effort in sociological terms. That is to say that Paul is resisting Jewish practices that might be used to reinforce a narrowly ethnic exclusivity. Another common feature is the rejection of any unmediated dichotomy in Paul between Christianity and Judaism, between law and grace, between faith and works, between atonement and participation, or indeed between individual and corporate elements of salvation. For all its undoubted diversity, in this respect, the new perspective is rather easier to identify and to describe than the third quest. Unlike historical Jesus research, it tends characteristically to be more concerned with certain aspects of Pauline soteriology rather than making any comprehensive claims about the words and deeds of the historical Paul of Tarsus. And perhaps for the same reason, however, the new perspective has also generated a much more strongly defined backlash in a number of quarters, not least among certain conservative German and to some extent North American Protestants. Even more than the third quest, the new perspective has remained a predominantly Anglophone, North Atlantic, and specifically Protestant pursuit. No major contribution from a Roman Catholic has appeared to date. Throughout all this, it is sadly ironic that the new perspective has failed to advance the discussion precisely in areas where it might have been expected to do so. Three examples might suffice to illustrate this point. First, Pauline scholarship seems to have come no nearer any kind of consensus on the supposedly all-consuming divisions between Paul and anti-Paulinists in early Christianity. While the German scholar F.C. Bauer's influential position today, ironically, has relatively few adherents in its undiluted form, especially in his native Germany, Anglophone sympathizers continue to prosper and proliferate both within and without the new perspective. Secondly, we seem to have very few tools to resolve the division between advocates of a narrative, salvation historical approach to Paul and those who would favor the supposedly more apocalyptic interpretation of Ernst Caseman or J. Louis Martin, according to which Paul largely abandons salvation history, especially in Galatians. Supporters of the new perspective are again found on both sides of this debate. Finally, and somewhat ironically, the new perspective has not managed to assuage fundamental Jewish suspicions about Paul. Although scholars like Daniel Boyarin or Alan Siegel do share a determination to take Paul more seriously on Jewish terms, at the end of the day, Pauline hermeneutics and politics vis-a-vis Israel remain deeply suspect for Jewish readers. Other unresolved questions include the continuing lack of clarity about Paul's interest in Jewish Christianity, in a mission to Israel, or in a continuing moral function of the law. And even after the new perspective, some scholars have happily returned to a position on the Jesus and Paul problem, which is in important respects indistinguishable from that of Rudolf Bultmann in the last century. Paul's Christ, on this view, could have no truck with a Jewish Jesus. So what is new about the new perspective? At the end of the day, of course, it may be that in this endeavor, as in some other areas of New Testament scholarship, progress amounts to rather less than meets the eye. Even supposedly cutting-edge Jesus scholarship may involve a greater degree of intellectual appearance and fashion than its practitioners may sometimes like to think. For my present purposes, it seems right to prioritize E.P. Sanders and James Dunn, two writers who are widely perceived as having to date made perhaps the most prominent contributions to both the Third Quest and the New Perspective. And placing their works in chronological order, I will interleave between them a consideration of John Dominic Crossan and N.T. Wright. First then, to Simon Peter in E.P. Sanders' Jesus and E.P. Sanders' Paul. And for chronological reasons, I will reverse these and begin with Paul. Sanders' work on the Pauline New Perspective predates that on the Third Quest. Perhaps partly for that reason, the question of continuity or discontinuity with the Jesus tradition is far from prominent in books like Paul and Palestinian Judaism, 1977, or Paul, the Law and the Jewish People, 1983. For a reflection on Paul, which might be informed by his work on both subjects, Jesus and Paul, we can turn only to his recently reissued popular title, Paul, A Very Short Introduction. And as we'll see, it is indeed in that late work that Sanders turns considerably less taciturn on the role of Peter. One might wonder if the popular tone of that series encouraged him to let his hair down a little bit. Sanders became notorious for claiming, as also in the subtitle of Paul and Palestinian Judaism, that he was interested not in theology, but merely in a historical comparison of patterns of religion. Despite these protestations, the chief concern of his two big books on Paul was an emphatically soteriological one. To wit, he wanted to study the dynamic of grace and merit in human salvation. One might say that for all the bluster and overstatement of Jacob Neusner's famously petulant critique of Paul and Palestinian Judaism, he did quite rightly query the remarkably Protestant theological shape of that question about grace and merit. Indeed, only the final chapter of Paul, the Law, and the Jewish People ventures marginally outside that remit of soteriology to consider some closely related aspects of Paul's view of Israel. Although, of course, in subsequent publications, Sanders has considerably expanded his coverage of ancient Judaism, this is not nearly so true for his work on Paul. Understandably, perhaps, there is little interest in Peter, who remains a somewhat two-dimensional, colorless figure with virtually no personality or teaching of his own. He does seem to function as a figure of continuity in the most general sense of embodying Jewish Christianity, but aside from this most general of connections, there are no concrete points of contact with the Jesus tradition. So, for example, Peter's resurrection appearance or Paul's visit with Peter in Jerusalem, Galatians 1:18, 1 Corinthians 15, these are sometimes adduced in this connection. These are two passages that are never even mentioned in either of Sanders' big books on Paul. At the same time, Peter stands for Sanders, above all, as a cipher of discontinuity with the Apostle to the Gentiles, whose sharply contrasting relationship with Judaism Sanders famously characterized in the statement, quote, "In short, this is what Paul finds wrong with Judaism. It is not Christianity," unquote. And thus, in discussing Paul's view of continued law observance, Sanders in 1977 took sharp exception to the so-called status quo theory associated with Albert Schweitzer and W.D. Davies. Sanders explains that Schweitzer fails to explain why in Galatians Paul is so passionately opposed to Gentile law observance and yet so unconcerned about Peter's supposed non-observance at Antioch, rather than, as Schweitzer's theory would demand, that Jewish Christians always keep the law. Instead, Paul had no objection to Peter's keeping of dietary laws per se, but considered it only wrong because it cut him off from Gentile Christians and would lead to the wholly unacceptable establishment of two separate Christian churches. And conversely, in Sanders' view, Galatians locates the key difference between Peter and Paul in the fact that whereas Peter could tolerate Gentile Christian non-observance, Paul's exclusivist soteriology required such non-observance. Thus, Sanders considers the possibility, which for Daniel Boyarin has become a fundamental principle, the possibility that Paul, unlike Peter, insists on the radical obliteration of all distinctions between Jews and Gentiles. Indeed, it is precisely Peter's continued acceptance of such distinctions that constitutes Peter's hypocrisy, as Paul calls it. Sanders also shows moderate sympathy for C.K. Barrett's revived Tübingen theory that the relationship between Paul and Peter was one of lasting enmity and rivalry, not just in Antioch, but in Corinth and elsewhere. Even if Paul generally abided by the terms of the Jerusalem Agreement and concentrated his efforts on Gentiles, Peter may indeed have meddled in Paul's churches. At the same time, the Jerusalem Agreement shows that Peter and James basically agreed with Paul on the question of the Gentiles, including the fact that they did not need to proselytize. The reason for Peter's withdrawal from Gentile fellowship was therefore probably, says Sanders, his sense of loyalty to the Jewish mission rather than any disagreement with Paul's Gentile mission. Given the likely numbers involved in the first century, it's interesting to note Sanders' quite untroubled conviction that whereas Paul's mission to the Gentiles has been a huge success, the mission of Peter and others to the circumcised had largely failed. What about Sanders on Jesus? Well, although his publications on the Gospels date back to the 1960s, Sanders' two main books on Jesus are the more programmatic 1985 study, Jesus and Judaism, followed in 1993 by his somewhat more accessible and more synthetic work, The Historical Figure of Jesus. In Jesus and Judaism, Sanders promotes many of his distinctive methodological principles, including the greater emphasis on certain core narrative assertions within the Jesus tradition, and thus a prioritizing of a minimum core of what he calls almost indisputable facts. One of these facts, although admittedly the least certain on the list, is Jesus' calling of 12 disciples. Sanders does not, however, offer any kind of real discussion of these individual disciples. That is quite different 8 years later, when in The Historical Figure of Jesus, he presents a much fuller, more rounded picture, both of Jesus and of other figures associated with the early Christian movement. Quite possibly because of a greater confidence in the validity of this new method, of the Third Quest's more sanguine estimation of narratival traditions, now there are extensive discussions of the disciples as a group, and we also find repeated comments on Peter in particular. Along with his brother Andrew and the sons of Zebedee, Peter is among the four chief disciples. Basic gospel outlines of the story of Peter are now explicitly affirmed, including his profession as a poor fisherman who apparently could not afford a boat, but who had a house in Capernaum that formed the setting for Jesus' healing of his mother-in-law. Peter made a messianic affirmation about Jesus, but was rebuked for his interpretation of it. Sanders also mentions a number of other Petrine episodes, while usually taking care not to move beyond descriptive to historical statements. Nevertheless, in analyzing Matthew's account of Peter walking on the water, Sanders does in fact conclude that this is what he calls historicizing legend. And he says this: "It is really true, for example, that Peter wavered in faith. He did so first when Jesus was arrested. He followed from afar and denied that he was one of Jesus' followers when he was asked. Later, he also wavered on the question of whether or not Gentile converts to the Christian movement should be required to observe the Jewish food laws, and Paul claimed that he acted hypocritically. Peter's inability to walk on water, according to this explanation, is only a pictorial representation of a character failing. It describes his weakness by narrating a brief legend." Thus far, Sanders. Sanders' apparent willingness to rescue even a minimal historical kernel from this most homiletical of Matthew's Haggadic discourses is symptomatic of the wider trend that I noted above. That's to say, Sanders' willingness to take seriously the integrity of the gospel narrative in arriving at a more rounded, flesh-and-blood picture of the historical Jesus. And here, as in other contexts, we encounter a willingness to link the Peter of the Jesus tradition with the apostle to the circumcised, as he appears in the Pauline epistles. In one passage, he even cites Galatians 2 as corroborating evidence for the claim that Peter was the leading disciple of Jesus. To be sure, Sanders remains a little more skeptical of Luke's attempt in Acts 10 to depict Peter's vision at Joppa as Jesus' instruction that all foods are clean. Had Paul known of such a tale, he surely would have worked it into his argument, says Sanders. And it is true that Sanders' earlier work on Paul, like his first book on Jesus, had precious little to say about Peter, or for that matter, about other connections between Jesus and Paul. Nevertheless, Sanders' overall portrait of Jesus does clearly move beyond the older Jesus scholarship in allowing for Peter as a substantive link between Jesus and Paul. This view is confirmed in his little book, entitled Paul, a very short introduction, first published in 1991 and then reissued in 2001 with this new title. Many of the earlier themes are repeated. Peter and others had not been very successful in their mission to Israel, while the difference between the urbanite cosmopolitan Paul and the Galilean Peter, quote, could hardly have been greater, unquote. Yet, Sanders bases his understanding of their relationship not on an a priori ideological polarity. Instead, he develops a synthetic view of both Pauline epistles and Acts, which he regards as reliable on the main events, even if its consistently harmonious view of the relationship between Peter and Paul masks their sometimes fierce disagreements. Chief among these disagreements is evidently the dispute at Antioch, although Sanders sheds no real light on the motivation for Peter's conduct. At the same time, he does acknowledge that while the sermons attributed to Peter in Acts place rather more stress on the life of Jesus and somewhat less on the parousia, otherwise they do reflect fairly closely what Paul's letters tell us about his own basic missionary message. Overall, one must say that Sanders does remarkably little to bring his work on the new perspective into dialogue with that on the third quest. On the positive side, there is for him no doubt about Peter's historicity in either of these research projects. Although there's virtually no sustained reflection on how Paul relates to Jesus, Peter does play a small part in what is perhaps a measure of development toward a more synthetic view from Sanders' early work on Paul to that on Jesus, and then to the later semi-popular guide on Paul. Turning now to John Dominic Crossan. Like Sanders, Crossan first contributed to New Testament scholarship in the 1960s, although his more notable impact began with his no less than 10 books and numerous articles published in the 1970s and 80s on matters like parables, narrative, eschatology, canonical and apocryphal gospel sources. All this prepared him well to burst on the scene in 1991 with his hugely successful work, The Historical Jesus. This book reflects in part his membership in the so-called Jesus Seminar. It is the members of that group have at one time or another included other leading Jesus scholars like Robert Funk, Marcus Borg, Stephen Patterson, and others whose own books on the subject manifest cognate methods to those employed by Crossan. Crossan's first Jesus book, an instant bestseller, was soon followed by several others, of which his book called Jesus, A Revolutionary Biography, was perhaps the most influential. Crossan is somewhat unusual among my list of major luminaries, since he is the only one not to have produced books specifically on both Jesus and Paul. In my defense, I would say that nevertheless, as one of the Jesus Seminar's most prolific and best-known authors, he is perhaps one whose book, The Birth of Christianity, does come closest to writing about Paul, although primarily with negative conclusions, as we'll see. And I'll return to that in a minute. First, we turn to Peter and Crossan's Jesus. There are relatively few episodes of Petrine interest in the two-sided books on Jesus. In keeping with his minimalist inventory of authentic sayings based on a preference for the hypothetical sources of Q, especially the earliest layer of Q, and an uncommonly early dating of the Gospel of Thomas, Crossan regards the entire early Petrine narrative of Mark 1 as unhistorical, but imbued nonetheless with symbolic value. Peter's house is becoming a brokerage place, he says, for Jesus' healing, and Peter will broker between Jesus and those seeking help. In particular, the episode of Peter's early morning search for Jesus in chapter 1 of Mark, 1:35 to 38, is the evangelist's creation, which shows that Mark opposes Jesus to Peter and shows there, from Mark's point of view, incompatible visions of mission. The passage serves primarily to demonstrate the opposition between Peter's brokerage, favorite term for Crossan, and Jesus' more radical view of itinerancy. A similar pattern surfaces in Mark's three passion predictions of chapters 8 to 10. Both the predictions and the reactions of Peter and others form part of Mark's programmatic denigration of them. Although Peter is in practice a largely irrelevant figure for Crossan, this anti-Petrine spin resurfaces in a number of other places, later on, for example, in relation to the resurrection. Luke 24 demonstrates how Peter's witness preempts that of others, by imposing the primacy of a specific leader over the general community. Similarly, in John 21, the evangelist manifests not exactly subtle apologetics used to justify the authority of the Petrine individual vis-a-vis the community and the leadership group. Although Crossan does concede that the same story, in his view, occurs previously in Luke's call narrative, chapter 5, where it perhaps less explicitly develops authority for Peter. Staying with the resurrection, the equally fictional tradition about Mary Magdalene in Matthew 28 has, in Crossan's view, been suppressed by the time we get to the story about Mary in John 21, where she misinterprets the resurrection three times. As might be expected, the stories of John 20 and 21 are also seen to raise the classic question of the envisaged conflict of Peter and John in terms of institutional as against charismatic, hierarchical against egalitarian, patronal against servile leadership. This trajectory is grounded for Crossan in the concluding logion of the Gospel of Thomas, Thomas 114, seen by many other writers as a late addition, but interpreted by Crossan as epitomizing Simon Peter's misogynistic opposition to female leadership, a stance in which, historically, says Crossan, Peter succeeds. The Da Vinci Code in a nutshell, you might say. In his sequel, entitled The Birth of Christianity, Crossan claims to exclude Paul in order to concentrate on the 30s and 40s of the first century. He does so by setting apart these two decades, the 30s and 40s, from what he calls the historical Paul in the 50s. Added to this is his prior belief in a radically dualistic, Platonizing Paul, who has so thoroughly broken with all of Palestinian Jewish Christianity that he is no longer any kind of representative of it. "I bracket Paul," writes Crossan, "to concentrate on a Christianity that had to be born before he could notice its existence and persecute its presence." Although he agrees with Daniel Boyarin's view of Paul as attempting to work out some sort of compromise between Judaism and Hellenism, the upshot seems, from another perspective, rather to cohere with aspects of Sanders's black and white contrast between Paul and Judaism. Crossan also takes considerable exception to what he regards as Paul's failure to apply his compromise on ethnicity to the issues of class and gender. Paul's fundamentally dehumanizing Platonism is for Crossan most apparent in his supposedly radical and only rarely compromised hostility to the body. Now, to be sure, one might want to say that the problem with Crossan's scheme is that to a majority of scholars, the 30s and 40s would constitute precisely the formative period from Paul's conversion, perhaps around AD 34, via his missionary activity in Judea, Arabia, Antioch, Asia Minor, and Greece, to the Jerusalem Conference and his Galatian and Thessalonian correspondence in AD 49 or 50. It is hard to see how one can speak of Christianity's birth in these years while taking extensive account of the Gospel of Thomas and the Didache, but programmatically excluding Paul. Among other things, this requires one to ignore, as Crossan studiously does, the work of Martin Hengel, Rainer Riesner, and others who have written extensively on Paul's life and thought during the 30s and 40s, decades that also involved troubled and sporadic and yet continuing contacts with Jerusalem Christianity. But regardless of what one makes of Crossan's construal, what matters for my present purposes is simply that, for all his protestations to the contrary, the birth of Christianity does in fact represent a substantial, if perhaps largely oblique, verdict on Paul, or you might even say perhaps an apophatic verdict on Paul. If Crossan's 650-page vision of the 30s and 40s is restrained on Paul, it is even more remarkable for having virtually nothing to say on Peter. Unlike numerous other ancient persons, both Christian and non-Christian, Simon Peter does not appear in the index. Although he does surface from time to time, partly as the redactional plaything of Mark or of John. Crossan offers a dyadic interpretation of Jerusalem Christianity as simultaneously sustained by a male process of exegesis and a female process of lament. And in the absence of a body or of a tomb, female ritual lament is what changed prophetic exegesis into biographical story, both of the passion and of the resurrection. Crossan is keenly interested in what he calls communities of resistance, among whom he includes the Essenes and also the group around James the Just. And in this connection, he acknowledges that Paul's letters do show both James and Simon Peter to have been important figures in early Christianity. Indeed, he even suggests that Galatians 1:18 might make one think that Cephas was more important than James at the time of Paul's visit to Jerusalem. Only James and the community around him, however, merit any sustained discussion, or for that matter, an entry in the index. Peter was, it seems, important, but we never discover how or why. He is largely airbrushed out of both the Jesus tradition and the Jerusalem church of the first two decades. This astonishing historical invisibility of Peter also strikes one in Crossan's remarkably pallid sketch of the Antioch dispute between Peter and Paul, generally held to be one of the two where Peter's role is that of a soulless functionary without any character or theology of his own. Peter and Barnabas, says Crossan, presumed that kosher regulations were no longer important, one way or the other. It was not important to follow them, but neither was it important to not follow them. Hence, before James's intervention, they ate with pagans like pagans. After it, they wanted everyone, including pagans, to eat like Jews. Paul called that hypocrisy. They probably considered it courtesy. Paul, in any case, refused to give in, found himself isolated, and, in my view, went westward, never return to Antioch. Thus far, Crossan. Peter is, in other words, a flat-footed, unthinking peasant whose brokered vision of faith shares little with those of either Jesus or Paul, but is opposed to them both, as indeed Jesus and Paul are to each other. Let me turn now to N.T. Wright. Like all the authors I'm discussing here, Tom Wright has produced a mind-boggling volume of literary output. Leaving aside his enormously popular For Everyone series of New Testament expositions, his most definitive scholarly books in our present area of interest have included Jesus and the Victory of God, 1996, and The Resurrection of the Son of God, 2003. Earlier scholarly books on Paul included The Climax of the Covenant, 1991, and What St. Paul Really Said, 1992. We should probably also include his commentaries on Colossians, 1986, and Romans, 2001. Our study is somewhat hampered by the fact that Wright's major series, entitled Christian Origins and the Question of God, has not yet progressed beyond volumes 2 and 3 on Jesus to the promised major monograph on Paul. And so as a result, I'm somewhat restrained by the largely topical and theological nature of what Wright has said so far in his scholarly work on Paul. So very briefly, to begin with, something on his Paul and then rather more on Jesus. Wright's Paul remains, thus far at least, fairly taciturn about Simon Peter. Only the popular volumes on Romans and on Galatians and Thessalonians in the Paul for Everyone series refer to Peter in passing, as does the larger commentary on Romans. In the commentary, there is virtually no discussion of the likely origin of Roman Christianity beyond explaining that it was founded by someone other than Paul. At Romans 15:20, Wright considers in the commentary, but then leaves open the possibility that the man upon whose apostolic foundation Paul does not want to build could be Peter. That's a possibility which seems to have slightly strengthened in the popular volume on Romans in the Paul for Everyone series. Writing on Galatians in that same series, Wright considers that the readership may already know about the dispute between Peter and Paul at Antioch, possibly from a report that assigned to Peter the stronger arguments. Paul's rebuke of Peter was partly for masking and play-acting, that's based on a familiar etymologizing interpretation of the word hypocrisis, and Paul rebukes Peter for compromising on his own better knowledge about the essence of Christian identity as transcending the Jew-Gentile distinction. But in the scholarly works on Paul published so far, it is quite difficult to find consistent reflection on the role of Peter, for example, as a tradent of Jesus' tradition or as a traveling missionary. So with that somewhat minuscule comment, I must then turn to Peter in Wright's Jesus. Even in Wright's massive works on Jesus, Petrine pickings are surprisingly slim. He has sometimes been accused of paying insufficient attention to questions of authenticity in his Jesus research, and that impression is partly confirmed in his handling of Simon Peter, whose five appearances in Jesus and the Victory of God all take the form not of analytical judgments, but of gospel paraphrase, even in key passages like the confession at Caesarea Philippi. Indeed, although he knows that Jesus is famously controversial to Peter as the rock of the church, Matthew 16, that this is frequently regarded as secondary, Wright cites Ben Meyer in support of the view that it is a further, evidently historical affirmation of Jesus' messianic status. Similarly, unlike Crossan, Wright declares the call to discipleship of Peter, Andrew, James, and John, without further ado, to be an indubitable historical event, even if recast through the different stories of all four evangelists. No attempt is made to reconcile the Lucan or Johannine narratives of Peter's call with those of Mark or Matthew. Despite the volume's length of over 700 pages, a number of Petrine episodes are entirely absent, and these range from Jesus' early visit to the house of Peter to heal his mother-in-law, all the way to Peter's drawing his sword at Jesus' arrest. Even Peter's denial is mentioned only in a single passing footnote as confirming Jesus to be a true prophet, not perhaps the first thing that might come to mind on that subject. Rather, more attention is paid to Peter in the resurrection of the Son of God. Now, some of this, again, amounts to little more than narrative paraphrase. Peter's speeches and healing miracles in Acts, Peter's escape from prison, the New Testament resurrection accounts, Paul's knowledge of Peter as Cephas and his missionary journeys, and so on and so forth. There are brief discussions of extra-canonical traditions about Peter in 1 Clement and in Ignatius, but neither of these is explored for any significant Petrine implications. The same is true both for 1 and 2 Peter and for the later Petrine pseudepigrapha. Wright explicitly takes issue with what he calls the modern consensus on the resurrection narratives, one part of which is to stress stories which pit one apostle against another, the women against the men, Peter and John against one another, and so on. Instead of this, Wright strongly resists attempts to see any of the resurrection narratives as playing off a particular disciple or form of Christianity against another, whether that be associated with Mary Magdalene, with Peter, or with someone else. Similarly, the Easter experience of Peter and the others cannot be reduced, as for example Edward Schillebeck has proposed, to a conversion-like experience of grace and forgiveness. Elsewhere, in summarizing the points of contact and agreement between the diverse canonical accounts of the resurrection, Wright stresses the agreement between Luke and John that after the women's discovery of the empty tomb and encounter with an angel, Peter and one other disciple visit the tomb to see for themselves. He also finds it highly likely that Mark intended to continue his gospel beyond 16:8 with an account that would have looked somewhat like Matthew's, including Peter and the other disciples meeting Jesus in Galilee and being commissioned to take the gospel to the nations. All in all, writes Peter, remains largely within the confines of the biblical narrative. Little fresh analysis is introduced, and there is no real discussion of questions such as Peter's role vis-a-vis the Jesus tradition, his potential bridging function between the Jewish and Gentile mission, or for that matter, his developing relationship with Paul over the period of the Pauline letter corpus. And so we turn finally to James Dunn, who invented the nomenclature of a new perspective on Paul in 1983. Like Sanders, Dunn has been a major voice in scholarship on both Paul and Jesus, with articles and large books amounting to thousands of printed pages. Most recently, he has advanced his work on memory and tradition as what he calls a new perspective on Jesus, with a forthcoming book of that title as well. For chronological reasons, once again, I'll proceed from Paul to Jesus. James Dunn's work on the new perspective is earlier, more substantial, and probably somewhat more influential than that on Jesus. Not only is it he who coined the nomenclature for this school of thought two decades ago, but he's contributed numerous significant books and articles both before and since that time. There are major commentaries on several Pauline letters, including Romans and Galatians, influential monographs on unity and diversity in the New Testament, on Christology, on the parting of the ways, on Jesus, Paul, and the law, and an 800-page theology of the Apostle Paul, not to mention numerous articles and several other edited books on relevant topics. And so the sheer volume of material dictates that we must be eclectic, and I would like to concentrate my efforts here on the exposition of the dispute between Peter and Paul at Antioch. In his exposition of Galatians, Dunn affirms that Paul's visit to Jerusalem to get to know Cephas is the apostle's way of gingerly wanting, quote, neither to claim too much nor to deny too little. Peter is clearly recognized as a man with a key position, but Peter did not commission Paul, nor did he instruct Paul on the meaning of the revelation on the Damascus Road. Instead, the substance of this extensive two-week visit within less than 5 years of the death of Jesus specifically involved learning about Peter as Jesus' leading disciple in Galilee, and thus a fairly substantial level of information content, as Dunn puts it, about the beginnings of the Jesus movement. Moving on to Galatians 2, Paul's account of the Jerusalem conference establishes a close analogy, although perhaps not quite an equation, between Paul's role in the Gentile mission and Peter's apostolic importance and considerable success in the mission to Israel. And it's worth noting that, in contrast with Sanders' insistence, that Peter's mission had largely failed. Dunn has spelled out his influential interpretation of the Antioch dispute in several publications, and my main interest here is in how he presents the person of Peter. Peter's described not unreasonably as having, in Paul's view, gone back on the Jerusalem agreement about the equivalence of their two assignments, although Dunn rightly implies that Peter had in fact come to Antioch not to interfere, but in pursuit of his own mission to Israel. Like all other interpreters examined in this paper, Dunn views Paul's charge of hypocrisy as attacking Peter for responding to the prompting from James by withdrawing from table fellowship with Gentile Christians. And it's worth noting that the assumption is that they were Christians. The diversity of Jewish contacts with Gentiles is rightly emphasized by Dunn over against more simplistic viewpoints, such as the notion that Jews never ate with Gentiles. Peter's change of practice, suggests Professor Dunn, is not from complete non-observance of food laws to observance of food laws, but rather from a position of presuming the acceptability of Gentile food, somewhat along the lines of 1 Corinthians 10, to a position of insisting on basic food rules, or in other words, from a soft to a hard interpretation of the Jerusalem agreement. Peter's withdrawal and separation returned him to a pretense of playing the Pharisee, but it may also reflect a real ambivalence about whether at Antioch the appropriate modus vivendi was or should be in keeping with the Jewish mission or with the Gentile mission. Peter's temporary mode of living like a Gentile, as Paul puts it, using a slogan of intra-Jewish polemic, meant not that he had totally abandoned Jewish praxis, but rather a mode of life which for the nationalists transgressed what they regarded as specific boundaries of identity. Peter's hypocrisy, therefore, is not a matter of acting against his own best convictions, but rather his inability to see that his behavior compromises the Jerusalem agreement as Paul understood it. As for Peter's fear of the circumcision, this is for Dunn best understood in terms of nationalist zealots in Jerusalem, although these probably included, says Dunn, believers. Peter's action, he surmises, was motivated probably by the desire not to cause scandal to fellow Jewish believers, and he accepted the argument of James's people that the Jerusalem agreement required Jews to live as Jews rather than as Gentiles. And so in this context, to compel Gentiles to Judaize, as Paul puts it, cannot refer to a compulsion to convert to Judaism, but to assimilate one's lifestyle to that of Jews. At the root of the Antioch dispute, therefore, is for Dunn a clash of principles that appears to Paul as hypocrisy and to Peter and to some extent Barnabas as loyalty to the Mother Church's concern for the Jewish identity of the mission to Israel. Paul describes the outcome of the argument with Peter as a victory for the gospel, but it is really a defeat. He doesn't claim that Peter accepted his rebuke and reverted to his former practice. Indeed, Paul received no backing from the Antioch church, whether Jews or Gentiles. If anything, says Dunn, Peter's position prevails at Antioch. The more liberal Gentile table fellowship accommodated itself to the more Jewish one. Dunn describes the upshot of the dispute as a Pauline breach with Jerusalem, with Barnabas, and with Antioch, though not, interestingly, as a breach with Peter. In fact, just at the point where you might like him to say something about Peter, Peter's dropped. Although seemingly inclined to think that all three breaches, Jerusalem, Barnabas, Antioch, seem subsequently to be reconciled or at least mitigated, Dunn says no more about the future of Paul's relationship with Peter. Turning next to Dunn's Jesus. In Jesus Remembered, Professor Dunn has relatively little to say about individual disciples. But he has a notion of a living tradition organized around apostolic memory and diverse oral performance of the gospel tradition, which does involve for him a category of apostolic custodians, among whom Peter, James, and John are recognized as leading figures from the first. So it's significant that in all lists of disciples, Simon Peter is firmly at the top and Judas Iscariot firmly at the bottom. And Dunn stresses the essential historicity of the call of the two pairs of brothers, called as empowered missionaries, despite the fact that John's account shows the synoptic evangelists to be omitting earlier contacts between Jesus, Andrew, and Simon. Evidence for the early and persistent prominence of these custodians is found not only in Acts, but also confirmed for Dunn by their continuity with Paul's account in Galatians 2:9. And so he concludes, this correlates well with the remembrance of the Jesus tradition that Peter and the brothers Zebedee, so he says, had been closest to Jesus and thus were accounted principal witnesses to and custodians of Jesus' heritage. Three more specific aspects of the gospel tradition attract Dunn's attention. First, he accepts as reliable part of the remembered Jesus tradition John's assertion of Peter's birth in Bethsaida, his subsequent settlement in Capernaum, the so-called house of Peter discovered at Capernaum may for Dunn indeed be those of Jesus' own house, the remains of Jesus' own house. Dunn doesn't say how this is relevant or why, or indeed on what grounds he regards the reference to Bethsaida as reliable. The second significant Petrine feature is Peter's confession. Although undeniably important to the structure and redaction of Mark's gospel, the evangelist in fact draws on a well-rooted memory whose diverse written expression in the four Gospels is due to oral performance flexibility, as he says, and is confirmed in the independent attestation of this tradition in John chapter 6. The rather folksy informality of Dunn's method at this point surfaces, for example, in the suggestion that Peter and the early disciples would be almost certainly among the first to raise the issue of Jesus' messiahship, and Peter's blurting out the answer is in keeping with his character. Contrary to Bultmann's assertion that this episode is a displaced resurrection story, Dunn insists that it belongs in the ministry of Jesus, and a post-Easter origin is further rendered unlikely by the so-called criterion of embarrassment, namely that Peter is rebuked as Satan. Peter also then appears finally in the complex evidence surrounding the resurrection. In Dunn's view, the diversity of the resurrection accounts, especially the empty tomb accounts, reflects the retellings of a core tradition that would be characteristic of an oral traditioning process. The fourth gospel, we learn, emphasizes the eyewitness testimony of Peter, and it does so without in any way intending to repress the tradition surrounding Mary Magdalene. And so here there's an implicit sideswipe at Crossan's interpretation. The complex problem of the resurrection appearance to Peter elicits a very subtle and circumspect discussion, a nimble discussion of Luke 24 and 1 Corinthians 15. Dunn suggests that Luke's reluctance to describe what this experience must have been could possibly reflect Peter's own reticence on the subject. And that is a possibility deliberately set against the assertion of Gerd Ludemann and others that the resurrection stories, in fact, all the resurrection stories for Ludemann, derive from the modest claim of Luke 24:34, the Lord is risen and has appeared to Peter, with no description of what that might be. Related to this is the knotty question of what to make of the similarities between Luke's Petrine call narrative and the account in John 21. Dunn leaves unresolved the possibility that Luke may have come across a post-Easter appearance to Peter in Galilee, but one that may never have become part of the official tradition. So overall, the Peter of Dunn's Major Jesus book is a figure of fairly clear definition and significance, but whose profile remains largely in keeping with what one might expect from a synoptic reading of the four Gospels. Dunn's Paul is indeed interested in the Jesus tradition, but while the Jesus who emerges has a number of synoptic characteristics, Paul's knowledge of him seems to share few immediate links with the third quest's very Jewish Jesus. So there's little consideration that the shape of Peter's loyalty to the Jewish mission might reflect some of Jesus' own concerns for the restoration of Israel. Paul's occasional hints that he retains an interest in matters like Jerusalem, Davidide Christology, or Jesus' conflict with the Jewish authorities, these hints are not noted, but not explored with a view to cognate themes in the third quest. One might have expected him to draw those links. Dunn's work on Jesus is generally later than that on Paul and less bashful about allowing that the Peter of Galilee is also the Peter of Antioch. Even here, however, the primary stress lies less on personal continuity than on Dunn's anonymous living tradition of performative communities, as he puts it. And this should be set in contrast, I think, to the early Christian tradition, particularly in the early second century, that the nature of early Christian remembering was much more often formally tethered to the continuity of individuals. But that's something perhaps we must leave for another day. With this emphasis on an anonymous living tradition, the genuine potential to identify connections between his work on Jesus and on Paul, I think, is left without any clear criteria to distinguish between understandings of that traditioning process which are either excessively formal and restrictive, or else, on the other hand, excessively flexible and creative. And Dunn has problems with both kinds of interpretations, but he never gives us criteria as to how we might distinguish between them. I come then to some conclusions. At one level, the result of my survey can only be described as disappointing. Although three of the four writers here surveyed allow that Jesus and Paul are linked by a Petrine continuity in principle, in practice, none of them carry this through to any significant analytical engagement beyond the answers given by previous generations of scholars. For Sanders, this is because he views Paul and Peter as opposed to each other. Crossan thinks in addition that they are opposed to Jesus. For Wright and Dunn, it seems to be mainly a lack of sustained reflection on the problem. Although they've written more on both subjects than most people have time to read, it is almost as if in their mind's eye, the third quest and the new perspective continue as separate, almost sort of left brain versus right brain compartments of New Testament scholarship. The same, I suspect, would be seen to be true if we broadened our remit to those authors who have made major contributions to just one of these two areas of study. What's more, the relative non-communication between the Pauline and Jesus quests is further complicated by a lack of agreement about method, about topic definition, and about criteria, things that I sketched at the beginning. Beyond this, the work of these scholars is marked by a distinct lack of interest in other early Christian traditions about the relationships between Jesus and Peter, or Peter and Paul. Relationships that do need to be understood historically, however else you might assess them. As perhaps in Pauline and Jesus scholarship more widely, Peter seems repeatedly reduced to a kind of straw man or a literary whipping boy. Paulinists see him through the eyes of Paul as one who accentuates Pauline distinctives. Jesus scholars again see him as a sidekick, as a foil to Jesus. James Dunn, in my view, comes closest to having cleared the ground for a genuine breakthrough here, but to date, I would suggest that this potential remains unfulfilled, partly because it is not a high priority for any of his major projects, and partly because of certain weaknesses in method and criteria. In fact, it seems a little ironic that despite thousands of pages on both the new perspective and the third quest, up to now he has never quite managed to implement the following programmatic statement about Peter, which appeared as long ago as 1977 in the conclusion of Unity and Diversity in the New Testament. I hope you'll permit me to read a paragraph from that. Peter, he says, was probably in fact and in effect the bridge man who did more than any other to hold together the diversity of first century Christianity. Peter, as shown particularly by the Antioch episode in Galatians 2, had both a care to hold firm to his Jewish heritage, which Paul lacked, and an openness to the demands of developing Christianity, which James lacked. Others could link the development of new religion as or more firmly to its founding events and to Jesus himself. But none of them, including none of the rest of the 12, seem to have played any role of continuing significance for the whole sweep of Christianity. So it is Peter who becomes the focal point of unity for the whole church. Peter, who is probably the most prominent among Jesus' disciples. Peter, who, according to early traditions, was the first witness of the risen Jesus. Peter, who was the leading figure in the earliest days of the new sect in Jerusalem. But Peter, who also was concerned for mission, and who, as Christianity broadened its outreach and character, broadened with it, at the cost, to be sure, of losing his leading role in Jerusalem, but with the result that he became the most hopeful symbol of unity for that growing Christianity which more and more came to think of itself as the Church Catholic. Now, we may regard this as somewhat purple prose, which maybe needs to be toned down in the cold light of systematic study of the historical Jesus or the historical Paul. Nevertheless, as far as the correlation of these two projects goes, Dunn's 1977 conclusion has not yet lived up to its promise, although there may be more to come in the series, of which Jesus Remembered is only the first volume. Now, if this initial assessment seems rather gloomy, other signs do nonetheless suggest the possibility of a genuine sea change in our understanding of what a post-New Perspective Paul may or may not know about a post-Third Quest Jesus. And the key, ironically, may lie not so much in the works of those who have worked in both fields, but in bringing the most pertinent insights of each quest into conversation with those of the other. Interestingly, recent scholarship on both Peter and Paul in America, and especially in F.C. Bauer's native land, has tended to the clear affirmation of Peter as indeed a mediating figure between Peter as a mediating figure between Jesus and Paul, seeing their Antioch dispute in terms of a managed conflict rather than as a permanent all-out enmity over the heart of the gospel. Nicholas Taylor's thought-provoking recent survey of the Paul and Jesus question argues that the Third Quest has made too little use of recent Pauline scholarship, which in turn has become rather more sanguine about what Paul knew of Jesus. On this reading, this is Nicholas Taylor's reading, Paul's Jesus was born as a Jew linked with the Davidic line, whom the apostle regards as having been consciously Israelite and Torah observant as part of the covenantal obligations that this entailed. Paul was aware of conflict with the Jerusalem authorities as a major contributing factor to the crucifixion. He also had some significant knowledge of traditions about Jesus' teaching, delivered to his churches not in letters, but acquired in the form of catechesis, formal catechesis. Paul himself may, in Taylor's view, have gained his knowledge of teachings preserved by Mark, largely through his extended visit with Peter in Jerusalem. Among certain other writers on the Third Quest, one can find similar indications that Peter could emerge as one catalyst for a link between Jesus and Paul. John Meyer, for example, devotes much of Volume 3 of his magnum opus to the disciples, including a lengthy section on Simon Peter. The once popular notion that Simon Peter as a witness to the resurrection is discredited by Paul and other major New Testament authors seems to Meyer so implausible as to be reminiscent of a snake biting its tail. Nevertheless, Meyer's portrait of this apostle concludes by observing the extent to which Peter remains the same in various New Testament sources, both before and after Easter. He bridges in a singular way the ministry of the historical Jesus and the mission of the early church. Now, that claim of Meyer's is, of course, a tall claim, and one which I suspect even a project of Meyer's magnitude will have trouble establishing to everyone's satisfaction. But it is quite in keeping with a recent trend in German and North American scholarship on Peter, a trend that lends some credence to James Dunn's programmatic 1977 statement. So the figure of Peter, in other words, does seem to harbor some unrealized potential for relating the two projects that we're here examining, the Third Quest for a more coherently Jewish Jesus, and the new perspective on Paul, a Paul more articulately engaged with Judaism. Although Peter stands without doubt in a degree of tension with the aims of both Jesus and Paul, he is at the same time a unique bridge figure who embodies important connections from Jesus to the Jewish and Gentile missions, both historically and perhaps even theologically. Part of that Petrine continuity is to represent something of the radical Jewishness of the early Christian search for identity as it came to such seemingly contradictory expressions in Jerusalem, in Antioch, and in Rome. That's a point about which Boyarin has written very fruitfully. As we've seen, the leading players in both recent scholarly efforts have not as yet drawn these links very clearly, perhaps with a partial exception of Dunn. In the end, the jury is still out about whether Peter, or for that matter any other figure, could serve as a useful catalyst for that engagement between the third quest and the new perspective. But meanwhile, I offer this modest contribution in the hope that it may spark some discussion. Thank you.